The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Web Studio, Primetime Advertising Corporation, and the Law Office of Thomas Pinkerton. The views and opinions are solely those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent KCBQ or its sponsors. It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you hear there are many and varied manuscript copies of the Bible. How do we know which ones really belong in the New Testament canon? This is a fair question, and I will address the question in detail later on today. First, the latest news. Well, he finally did it. Obama has set the date. Our troops will be withdrawn from Iraq during the first month of August 2010. Somewhere in the Middle East, a memo is circulating amongst Al-Qaeda members. Target date for next major attack on Iraq, September 2010. Speaking of the Middle East, Michael Medved recently interviewed Jimmy Carter and asked how he could possibly conduct peace talks with the terrorist organization Hamas. Carter tried to sidestep the question by highlighting Israel's illegal occupation of Palestine. Medved reminded Carter that the Palestinian Charter called for the annihilation of Israel, something even the Hitler-authored Mein Kampf didn't say. Although Hitler planned to do such things and eventually carried out his plans, he did not commit it to writing, at least not early on. Carter's response, well, if you want to talk about the past, we can, but I am trying to work on the present. Jimmy, do we have to have another of our little talks? He was talking about the present. That clause is still in the charter. By the end of the conversation, you finally admitted as much, but you still failed to explain how peace talks with Hamas would accomplish anything other than the destruction of Israel. Maybe this should come as no surprise. Back when the Holocaust Museum was being built, a memo from President Carter went out to a staff member saying, "There are too many Jews on the Holocaust Committee." And now the man who wrote that memo has written a new book, just what the world needs. Another pile of paper condemning America, condemning George Bush, and explaining his own brilliant Middle East strategies both during and after his presidency. You just keep on talking, Jimmy. That's what you do best. Oh, by the way, your peace efforts have been extremely successful. The radical terrorists absolutely adore you. Yes, indeed, radical Muslims are very passionate about land, especially when they consider the land to be theirs, and especially when they consider the land to be holy. Often their definition of holy land merely means that at one time in history, Muslims were there. For example, Arab Muslims have no historical claim to the biblical Holy Land prior to the 600s when Muhammad introduced a new religion and commanded his followers to spread it with a sword. Should the Dome of the Rock be taken down from the Jerusalem Temple Mount, making way for Jews to rebuild a holy place that preceded Islam by some 1,600 warriors, World War III would begin. Visiting the old city of Jerusalem, I not only saw the controversial mosque, I was also introduced to an unexpected sight, Muslim graves built right on Mount Moriah at the entrance of the Golden Gate. Our tour guide explained, since Jews believe their Messiah will come to Jerusalem through this gate, and since Jews also believe it is sacrilege to trample on a grave, these graves are intended to ward off the coming of the Messiah. As I approached the final few days of my Israel tour, I felt increasingly grateful to my brother Paul and his wife Carol for giving me a guest room in a house that's actually quite small. Whenever Carol needed something from my temporary place of residence, she politely asked, "Do you mind if I get something out of your room?" I said, "Well, Carol, it's your room, not mine." Then, after reconsidering for a moment, I offered a revised statement. Of course, in the time-honored tradition of Islam, I guess it can be argued that since I placed my own items in this room, the room is now mine forever. We both laughed. This one time, at least, the process seemed funny. I wish it were funny all those other times in history. On the subject of humor, given the choice of laughing or crying over our new president, I guess I'd rather laugh. You recall a couple of weeks ago, I began to compare our politicians to some of the characters from Green Acres. Baby boomers will remember that loony CBS sitcom. Even if you are not a baby boomer, the program is screened frequently on TV land. It's also selling now on DVD. One of the characters, Mr. Kimball, was seldom able to complete a thought because his mind kept wandering and changing. Good morning, Mr. Douglas. Well, I guess I wouldn't call it a good morning because it looks like rain, but I still got up early. Well, not exactly early. Generally, I get up at 6 o'clock, and today I got up at 7 o'clock, although I wasn't actually up at 7 because I wasn't out of bed yet, but my eyes were open. Catching on? We'll get used to it. I think Mr. Kimball has been reincarnated in the form of our new president. I'm sure that our stimulus package will work. Well, I'm not exactly sure. That's why we have another one all ready to go if this one fails. But you won't find one single earmark in the package. Well, I suppose you'll find some, maybe 3,000 or so. But trust me, I plan to cut down on spending. Well, not really cut down. I mean, first we will spend about $1 trillion, but all of it is going to an important cause. Well, not all of it. Some of it goes to protect a mouse in San Francisco. But other than this, I am not really a believer in big government. Well, I guess I'm kind of a believer because in just 2 quick weeks, I have made the government bigger than 50 years worth of administrations. But this was a bipartisan bill. Well, not really bipartisan. After we listened to the Republicans, we put their suggestions where they belong, the wastebasket. But it was bipartisan in spirit, and now our country is safe. Nobody will dare to attack us now. Well, maybe North Korea or Iran, but nobody else because you won't catch me make deals with terrorists. Well, maybe with Hamas, because we need to give aid to Gaza, and all of that money will go for humanitarian efforts. Well, maybe not all of it. Hamas may steal part of it. Actually, I guess they'll steal all of it. But I'll give them money anyway, so that it can look like I care about the peace process. Say, Mrs. Douglas, that's a lovely hat. Well, maybe not a lovely hat. Okay, you catching on? But even a zany program like Green Acres cannot compare to the intellectual bankruptcy of the Academy Awards. Okay. We knew he would win the award, and sure, we also knew he would make some kind of political speech instead of merely saying thank you. And yes, based on his track record, we suspected the speech would be something incredibly outrageous. Still, none of the safe predictions braced us for the sheer pain and agony of Sean Penn's acceptance speech at the 81st Academy Awards. First of all, as for congratulating Hollywood for its courage, let's be honest. It takes no courage to make a movie supporting gay activism in Hollywood today. Back in the 50s or 60s, sure. But today? Try making a movie that calls Islamofascism what it actually is. Islamofascism. Now that would take courage. Try making a movie where a Republican cares about the poor. Or a minister is not corrupt. How about a character who loves homosexuals but merely disagrees with the lifestyle? On that day, we will see authentic bravery, because anyone who participates in such a film may not ever work in Hollywood again. Back to the acceptance speech. According to Penn, there is so much shame from the hateful Proposition 8 that we will not be able to face our own grandchildren. I sure am getting sick of this. The arrogance of a man who assumes that one cannot possibly oppose gay marriage without being filled with hate. The ignorance of a man unaware of the clinical studies disproving that all homosexuals are born that way. The hypocrisy of a man who claims to be tolerant but in fact cannot tolerate any opinion other than his own. The inability to understand an agenda that will someday make it against the law to speak negatively about homosexuals, even in church. The irony of an actor whose own father was once blacklisted, but who, instead of learning from his dad's experience, now spreads so much pressure in Hollywood that conservatives feel the need to keep their mouths shut or lose their jobs. Sean, I know you saw this as your towering moment and your finest hour, but frankly, someday future generations will look back at our culture, examine people such as yourself, study your speeches, marvel that millions once listened to you, and then on that day they will learn of a time when America exhibited genuine shame. Professors will try to explain how it happened. Talking heads will attempt to reveal how so many brains could have been thrown out the window. And that generation will say to its grandchildren, "Yes, kids, once upon a time, back in the olden days, it was actually considered extreme and hateful to believe that marriage was an institution for men and women." Well, get used to such rhetoric. The Democrats are in power now. The Democrats back when Republicans had the majority in Congress. The people want bipartisanship. Bipartisanship. We may be the minority party, but our voice should still be heard when legislation is made because the people want bipartisanship. The Democrats, now that they are in control of Congress once again, the people have spoken. Republicans, you lost the election. Deal with it. The Democrats on Proposition 8. Well, yeah, sure, the people have spoken. Sure, the people have spoken. But the people do not know what is best for them. That's why a few judges should overturn this new law. And now that this new stimulus package is giving them an excuse to run our health care, let's travel into the future of health care. So what's the verdict, doctor?
Well, Mr. Jensen, I'm afraid you need surgery, a triple bypass.
Wow, really? Huh, I guess I expected this. You did warn me. Okay, let's do it. When shall we schedule the operation?
Actually, Mr. Jensen, there will be no operation.
I'm sorry, my ears must be playing tricks. For a moment, I thought you said there would be no operation.
I take no pleasure in explaining this to you. The government will not allow your insurance provider to cover certain procedures unless there is a corresponding age.
Excuse me? What are you talking about?
Since turning to socialized health care, we now have certain guidelines. You are a senior citizen. You've had a rich, full life, but there are younger people, people with their futures ahead of them.
Is this some kind of joke? Am I in a new reality show? Where are the cameras, Mr. Jensen?
Your eating habits have been contrary to our new government guidelines, but our youth can be trained and educated to eat properly. With them, there are far more preventive measures which can be taken, and preventive measures are cheaper.
Did my friends put you up to this? All right, Fred, come on out from behind that door.
Mr. Jensen!
Maybe I'm just dreaming. Sure, that's it. In a moment, I'll wake up.
I'm terribly sorry, Mr. Jensen, but there is only so much money to go around. It is not our government's fault that you did not take care of yourself, and it is not our government's fault that we have so many senior citizens. Priorities must be put in order. We need to be fair to the entire village. Our youth come first. This is about helping youth. You believe in caring for our youth, don't you?
Are we talking about youth? Are we talking about euthanasia? Well, never mind. It doesn't matter. I'm just having a nightmare. In a moment, I'll awaken and the world will be sane once again.
I wish that were true, Mr. Jensen. I'm afraid our time is up for today.
Are you out of your freaking mind? I'm supposed to have free health care.
It is free. There will be no charge for the doctor's visit or for the tests we took. You still have your deductible, of course.
All right, if this futuristic short story seems like fiction, take some time to study what has been slipped into the health care portion of the latest stimulus package. Let's just hope the fun little clause gets removed before the bill passed like Arlen Specter and others promised it would. Some senators and congressmen confessed that they did not know it was in there. I'm glad to hear that. But it's still rather chilling to know they were about to vote on something they did not read. And frankly, at this point, I don't think anybody quite knows what's in that thing or what isn't in that thing. Obama promised change. How do you like the change so far? You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show. If you'd like to weigh in on any of this, you can give us a call at 1-888-344-1170. That's 1-888-344-1170. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. Our call-in toll-free number, 1-888-344-1170. Coming up, how do we know which manuscripts really went into the New Testament, since there are varied and contradictory manuscripts? You can also get a hold of us through email if you're shy about the phone, questions@bobsiegel.net. That's questions@bobsiegel, S-I-E-G-E-L, .net. Regarding Obama sounding like Mr. Kimball from Green Acres, Robin writes, "Thanks for the laugh. I just have to keep telling myself that God is in control." Regarding that same bit, Patty, all the way from Italy, writes, "Okay, this one is really funny. I mean, true, but so funny." Patty also comments about Sean Penn. "I cannot stand Sean Penn. We just have to remember that he's going to get his moment with God, too. It ain't going to be pretty if he does not change his ways. He's incredibly arrogant." Ugh, she writes. This is from Caddy. Now, many of you will remember Caddy. I've read his comments often. They're detailed. Our dialogues have gone on endlessly. He has commented quite extensively on my blogs, and I've read many of them over the air. Well, Caddy takes offense to the blog version of the little short story about the government overseeing healthcare decisions. And Caddy's never been more upset with me. Caddy writes, "Are you tired of using fear to manipulate? Insurance companies have been running the scam that you claim the government would. The difference between them is that insurance companies make those kinds of decisions with profit in mind. Why would the government say no?" Caddy, did you just ask me why the government would say no? Do you have to ask that question? A government that supports abortion and infanticide? A society that more and more embraces physician-assisted suicide? A government that thinks it knows what is best for us and wants to control our lives? You ask why this government would say no to a medical procedure? Are you asking that with a straight face? And now, Caddy, since you asked me some blunt questions, I have some questions for you. Are you tired of justifying one evil by pointing out another? Are you tired of giving knee-jerk reactions without actually thinking about what I am saying? I hate insurance companies and big government, but I'll tell you what I am tired of, Caddy. I'm tired of a man who justifies the left no matter what they do, and I'm tired of a man who gets into endless debate without ever conceding a point, even when he is disproven and contradicts himself time and time again. As for discussions over the internet, I do not find real debate advanced when one uses personal attacks, such as, are you tired of using fear to manipulate? I did not make up what was in that bill. I merely reported it. And if I wrote it in a creative way, well, that is why people read my blog. And that is why people listen to my radio show. But when you accuse me of manipulation, you are stabbing in the back a person who showed you kindness and respect. I went over the air and talked about how much I appreciated the mutual respect we had, even though we disagreed. Frankly, you owe me an apology. Do you treat your fellow profs and students this way when they disagree with you? Can you read minds, Caddy? You have looked into my soul, and you know that I am motivated to manipulate people. I've never manipulated a person in my life. Oh, by the way, we have had our last discussion. Your ad hominem attacks have frankly lowered your credibility in my eyes. The next email question concerns Islam. Bob, you have written and spoken on the radio a great deal about radical Islam. Do you believe there are peaceful Muslims? Yes, of course there are peaceful Muslims. There are many, and I have conversed with quite a few of them. I have had warm talks and exchanges with wonderful, loving Muslims. However, and it's a big however, whereas every Muslim must be judged on an individual basis, evaluating the Muslim religion itself is quite another matter. The Quran really does call upon Muslims to conquer the world, offering infidels the choice of converting or dying. And if you think that's not in there, I invite you to turn to the Quran, Chapter 9, or Surah 9, as they call it. Now you're saying, but Bob, only the terrorists take those words seriously. Not so. It is true that the terrorists, sadly, are interpreting the Quran accurately, but many Muslims who do not identify themselves as terrorists still abide by their own book, which makes sense. After all, to them, the Quran is sacred scripture. So am I saying there is no such thing as a moderate Muslim? Well, certainly there are many Muslims who call themselves moderate. However, I'm going to answer this question just as carefully as I can. The answer is backed up by my own reading of the Quran. I read the book years ago, long before 9/11. I read it word for word. I read it cover to cover. I have also interviewed experts on Islam, many such experts for my radio show. Here's the cold, painful truth. There are many nominal Muslims, but there are no moderate Muslims. The phrase moderate Muslim is a contradiction in terms. Now, what do I mean when I say nominal? Just as there are people who live in America or Europe
who know absolutely nothing about the Bible other than a few choice ideas taken out of context, people who nevertheless call themselves Christians because they were raised with some kind of church background. There are likewise many people born into Muslim countries or raised by Muslim families. If you asked them if they believed in the Quran, they would say yes. If you asked if they believed in the jihad, they would deny it, and they would be telling the truth. There are millions of such people, and yes, we can call them peaceful Muslims. However, any Muslim who takes the Quran seriously, any Muslim who takes the Quran literally, any Muslim who truly understands the entire message, not only accepts the jihad commands, he or she is also taught that it is okay to lie during a time of war, so they could say they don't believe in the jihad and really believe in it. Are you catching this? The Muslim apologist Nadir Ahmad admitted as much to me over the air. You can still go to my website and listen to his interview. Now, when are Muslims not at war? They can lie, but only when they're at war. Well, when are they not at war? That's a fair question. A question put to Nadir on the radio. He gave a vague, unsatisfactory answer. He's coming back on my show in a couple of weeks, so maybe he'll give a better answer at that time. But why not let Muhammad speak for himself? I'm reading from the Hadith. Muhammad says, lying is wrong, except in three things. The lie of a man to his wife to make her content with him. A lie to an enemy, for war is deception. Or a lie to settle trouble between people. Oh, well, just for those three cases. Okay. See the problem? Even the so-called moderate Muslims are allowed to lie and deny that they believe in the jihad. This explains how the moderate organization CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations, was caught having ties to terrorist organizations. Still, many Muslims, both nominal and radical, are turning to Christianity in epic proportions. As Christians, we must stress both sides of the gospel. The gospel includes the good news that people can be forgiven of their sin, and for that reason, we accept any truly penitent Muslim. But the gospel also delivers people from the effects of sin, which means we must also speak out against evil wherever it is being committed. And these days, much evil is being perpetrated in the name of Islam. There are many nominal Muslims, but a dedicated Muslim who accepts the Quran literally and truly understands the Quran is not allowed to be moderate. Nevertheless, Muslims of all varieties are reaching out for Christianity, and this is great news. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. If you'd like to send in a Bible question, you can reach me, questions@bobsiegel.net. That's questions@bobsiegel.net. Here's a question, and I mentioned this at the top of the hour. I have heard there are many differences when we read the Greek manuscripts of the New Testament, that many of the monks making copies changed things to promote their own theology or to harmonize one passage with a parallel account. If it is true that certain passages are in some manuscripts and not others, how do we know for sure what truly belongs in the Bible? Okay, it's a fair question. Now, it is true that certain passages are not in the oldest texts, but keep in mind that even our oldest texts are not the originals. The originals have been lost. For this reason, some scholars are more intrigued by what made it into the majority of the manuscript. Bottom line, these verses are few. If we kept them in or left them out, no material doctrine or teaching or truth from the Bible would be changed. As to why these differences occurred in the first place, let me illustrate by talking about a very familiar passage known as the pericope. You probably don't know it by that name, or you don't know it by the other name that theologians give it, the floating passage. But the floating passage refers to the verses in John 7:53 through 8:11. It's a beloved and popular account where Jesus rescues the woman caught in adultery from being stoned to death. Okay, the passage is found in only one unicole manuscript. What's a unicole manuscript? A unicole manuscript was a Greek manuscript written in all capital letters. Six manuscripts omit it completely. Two leave a blank space where it should have been found. As for late Greek and medieval manuscripts, even then it's often marked to show that its genuineness is doubted by some. The passage is not included in any Syriac, Coptic, or Egyptian versions, and it's left out of some of the early Latin versions. To make matters worse, none of the early apostolic fathers seem to know anything about it. The very first Greek commentator to say anything about it is Eusebius, and his date is very late, A.D. 1118. On the other hand, this passage is found in one relatively early unical document called Codex Basea, which dates sometime between the 5th and 6th centuries A.D. Jerome also knew of this account in the 4th century and included it in the famous Latin Vulgate. Augustine and Ambrose knew it also, and both men comment on it. The passage is in all the later manuscripts, but its order differs from place to place. In some manuscripts, it's found at the end of John. In other places, it follows Luke 21:38. You can see how it obtained the nickname Floating Passage. The floating passage is quoted in 3rd century books, one, for instance, entitled Apostolic Constitutions, where it is given as a warning to bishops who are too strict. Eusebius, the early church historian, says that Papias, who lived not long after 100 AD, tells a story of a woman who was accused of many sins before the Lord. Finally, although none of the early Greek fathers refer to the passage, several early Latin fathers do. How then do we explain this unusual passage? I believe Augustine provided the biggest clue. He says this was removed from the gospel because some were of slight faith and to avoid a scandal, quote unquote. You see, early in church history, the monastic movement spread like wildfire. Influenced by the Greek idea that anything pleasurable was a sin, monks were now taking vows of chastity and vows of poverty. These same monks were partly responsible for the transmission of the New Testament text. Even though forgiveness is a strong Christian virtue, there was a time where sexual purity was emphasized to the point where people could no longer see the forest for the trees. Some overenthusiastic monk may have removed this text because it seemed in his mind to be permissive of adultery, in his mind only, as the text clearly shows Jesus telling the woman, "Go and sin no more." Fortunately, emotional, overly enthusiastic monks were countered by the objective monks who had no agenda other than to transmit faithfully what the text really said. And so, in time, this interesting passage got put back in, but by that time people probably had no certainty as to where it should be placed. Because of its floating order, the passage may not actually belong to John. It does not seem to be in the written style of John's, but wherever it belongs, I am convinced that the story represents a genuine account of Jesus and does belong in the Bible. Next question. Is the Da Vinci Code something to be taken seriously? You thought we'd all forgotten about the Da Vinci Code. You thought it was a passing phase, didn't you? Well, there's a sequel, a movie sequel based on a novel written by Dan Brown, the same author, starring Tom Hanks again, being directed by Ron Howard again. I got to tell you, Ron Howard's credibility as a director gets lower and lower all the time. Is the Da Vinci Code something to be taken seriously? The question says, Bob, almost everybody I know has read the Da Vinci Code and is talking about it, either that or they've seen the movie. From what little I can gather, it sounds like some whole new interpretation about who Jesus really was. Exactly what is the Da Vinci Code and why do Christians seem so concerned about this book? Okay, the Da Vinci Code is a very well-written novel, and I like to be honest about that. I hate the novel. I hate it. But I'm going to be objective, and I'm going to be fair, and I'm going to be honest. It's a very well-written novel, but unfortunately, the author claims that his novel is based on sound historical research. Artistically, I give it a B+. As for the accuracy of the beliefs, one could defend unicorns more easily. Now, I'm not going to discuss the fictitious plot of the novel, but rather the background information the author claims is accurate. The author is Dan Brown. He's not an historian, nor does he claim to be, but he does claim to have done his homework. Da Vinci, of course, stands for none other than Leonardo da Vinci, the famous painter who supposedly belonged to a secret society called Priory of Sion. According to Brown, this society has labored since the time of Christ to protect itself from the Catholic Church, which was trying to bury their big secret.
Clues to unlocking this secret are found in some of Da Vinci's paintings, such as the Mona Lisa or the Last Supper. What's the big secret? Jesus Christ got married. He married none other than Mary Magdalene. Come on down. One of the female followers. They had a daughter who was taken away and hidden, and whose family survives to this day. In fact, Mary Magdalene is actually the Holy Grail you always hear about. Got that? Holy Grail is not a cup, but rather a symbol for the Holy Bride of Christ. Now, some might freak out at the idea of the Son of God being married, but it gets even better. The Society Prior of Sion is also guarding the fact that Jesus wanted his wife Mary to be the head of the church. They teach that Jesus was not God, that his deity was invented by 4th century Christians. In fact, the church was commanded to deify Jesus by the first Christian emperor, Constantine. The secret information passed down by Jesus' true followers teaches that we should worship many gods and goddesses. They particularly emphasize goddess worship, and these goddesses are often worshipped in the same manner as some of the ancient cultic rituals, through communal sex as a high point of the religious service. They claim that the Catholic Church tried to suppress the truth about Mary Magdalene being the head of the church because the church was run by a male-dominated society. For this reason, teachings of the Da Vinci Code may sound appealing to some radical feminists. As ancient sources, Dan Brown cites, among other documents, a scroll rejected by the early church entitled The Gospel of Mary. Okay, how do I respond to this? Well, even though he's only writing a novel, Dan Brown claims that the secret society, Priory of Sion, really exists. We'll talk about that society when we return to the Bob Siegel Show. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. We've been talking about the Da Vinci Code because there's a sequel movie directed again by Ron Howard, starring Tom Hanks again, based on another novel by Dan Brown. Now, although I said before the break, although he's only writing a novel, Dan Brown claims that the secret society that was protecting the secret that Jesus got married to Mary Magdalene, had a lineage, a society called Prior of Sion, he does say it really exists, that their practices and rituals really exist, that all documents referred to are real. For the sake of time, let's stipulate this. All we've proven is that a genuine society honestly believes Jesus got married. There are societies who don't believe we went to the moon. Just because some nutcase society exists, that doesn't mean jack. This does not prove that what they believe is actually true. To evaluate such a claim, we must go to the source of their beliefs, ancient history. Now, there is an ancient document called the Gospel of Mary, which supposedly hints at this relationship Jesus had with Mary Magdalene. If the church really thought that Mary wrote the Gospel of Mary, if the church really thought that Thomas wrote the Gospel of Thomas, if the church really thought that Philip wrote the Gospel of Philip, they would have included them in the New Testament canon, for they included everything truly written by apostles or other close companions of Jesus. But in those days, you need to understand, Christianity had become so popular, it was common for anyone wanting to fabricate a document to write the name of an apostle or another well-known figure right on top of it. The church was wiser than this, and they didn't blindly accept any document with a famous person's name scribbled on the top. A copy of the Gospel of Mary and many of these other extra-biblical gospels was discovered in Egypt in the year 1945 as part of a whole collection of Gnostic writings. What was Gnosticism? Gnosticism was an early heresy refuted by the early church. Gnosticism taught that Jesus did not resurrect from the dead, at least not physically, and that God did not create the earth. The earth was created by lower beings called eons. Gnosticism also taught that anything physical or material was evil. Only the spiritual and immaterial was good. This makes the Priory of Sion's high view of communal sex a bit contradictory, because most ancient Gnostics tended to frown upon sexuality. And when they did engage in sex for procreation purposes, they still believed it was something negative. Yet these same Gnostic documents are appealed to as evidence of the Priory's claims about Jesus and Mary. Gnostic documents date many years after the books of the New Testament. Let me say that again. Gnostic documents date many years after the books of the New Testament. The New Testament was completed by the end of the first century. The Gnostic Gospels date no earlier than the mid to late second century. And, folks, the Bible is not anti-woman or anti-woman in leadership. We don't need alternative scriptures to find a higher view of women. In Galatians chapter 3, Paul tells us that as far as status in the church is concerned, there is neither male nor female, but all are one in Christ. Can you imagine that? He's living at a time when in the Jewish culture, in the Greek culture, in the Roman culture, women were frowned upon. And he's saying that as far as social status goes, there's no such thing as male nor female. That was as radical, as liberal, as freeing as a religion could possibly be. In fact, Mary Magdalene herself is portrayed very positively in the New Testament. She is the first to encounter the resurrected Christ. She's the first to report the meeting to Jesus' male disciples who at first did not believe her. Go to John chapter 20. Go to Luke chapter 20. Now, although the Bible is not a chauvinistic book, it was written in a chauvinistic culture. In ancient Judaism, if a man talked to a woman in public, whether it was his own wife, his own sister, his own daughter, it was considered a disgrace. So reporting that a woman had been the first to witness the resurrection would not have been the shrewdest way to commit fraud and generate a legend. This says something about the integrity of the gospel writers. Let me also say a word here about the Catholic Church. I am not a Catholic myself. I'm not Catholic. But I at least want to defend the fact that Catholics over the ages had no incentive to oppress positive views of women. If they had such an anti-female agenda, why did they not omit these resurrection passages about Mary and Jesus? And of course, there's the other Mary. You may have heard of her, that a little Mary called Mary, the mother of Jesus. Catholics pray to the Virgin Mary. Now, I don't believe in praying to Mary, but they do. And that practice hardly shows a low view of women. Brown then, and I love this one, Brown then claims that Emperor Constantine demanded that Jesus be deified. Well, as a matter of fact, Christians were calling Jesus God all the way back to the first century when the New Testament was written. This same New Testament reports Jesus himself making the claim. I'm reading from John 14, 9 through 11. And what's going on is these guys have been following Jesus around for years. And Jesus is talking about their Heavenly Father. And he's saying the Heavenly Father wants you to do this. The Heavenly Father wants you to do that. And finally, Philip says, just show us the Father already. You keep talking about the Father. Show us the Father. Here are Jesus' chilling words. Jesus answered, don't you know me, Philip? Even after I've been among you such a long time, anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, show us the Father? Don't you believe that I am in the Father and that the Father is in me? The words I say to you are not just my own. Rather, it is the Father living in me who is doing this work. Believe me when I say that I am in the Father and the Father is in me. Also, if you go to the 8th chapter of the book of John, very interesting passage. Jesus refers to Abraham as if he had actually talked to him. Well, Abraham had lived a couple of thousand years before Jesus, so this would have been difficult. At least the religious Pharisees said that. They said, you're not even 50 years old. And you knew Abraham? And Jesus said to them, before Abraham was, I am. Now, even in those days, and even in the ancient language of Greek, that would not have been considered good grammar. Why didn't he say, before Abraham was, I was? Because the words, I am, meant something. When Moses encountered God at the burning bush, and you can read about this in Exodus chapter 3, God said to Moses, go to Pharaoh of Egypt and tell him, let my people go. And he said, well, Pharaoh believes in all kinds of gods. He's going to ask your name. The idea of monotheism was foreign to the Egyptians, probably foreign to Moses too. And he says, what's your name? Pharaoh's going to get out his yellow page catalog and go through the listings of different gods. They had a god for flies. They had a god for frogs. In fact, a lot of the
plagues put upon Egypt, flies, frogs, gnats. Those were all things the Egyptians worshipped. This was God showing a sense of humor. You like flies, eh? You like locusts? Here, worship these for a while. But anyway, Moses says to God, "What is your name?" And God says, "I am that I am." No, he wasn't Popeye. He said, "I am," meaning that's my name. Tell the Pharaoh, "I am," essentially. That is God's name given in the Bible, a name considered by the Jews too holy to actually pronounce. In fact, whenever you read the Old Testament, you come to the term "the Lord" in capital letters. That means the name for God was taken out, and the Hebrew word Adonai was substituted in its place. But in that one place, we see it, "I am." And when Jesus said to the Pharisees before Abraham was, "I am," he was calling himself by the name of God. In case there's any doubt that the Pharisees understood that exactly and precisely, they got out stones to throw at him. Why? Because for a Jew to claim to be God was blasphemy, unless he happened to be telling the truth. This is Bob Siegel.
Turn to the Bob Siegel Show.
Welcome back to our program. This is Bob Siegel. We've been talking about the Da Vinci Code. Now, as I mentioned before we went to the break, this idea that Emperor Constantine commanded the church to deify Christ is nonsense all the way back to the first century, and we can read about it in the New Testament. There are places where Jesus actually claimed to be God. I gave you two chief texts, John 8 and John 14, but there were many. Now, true. Some Christians still argued about the nature of Jesus because many of those New Testament verses were hard to fathom. They were there, but they were hard to fathom. How could a man be God? And so the church did not officially ratify this belief until the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD. And yes, this council was sponsored by Constantine. But all Constantine said was, "Settle this question about whether or not Jesus is God. I don't care how you settle it, just settle it." You see, Constantine was a warrior. And he became the emperor by winning a battle. He won the battle because he got this vision, and in the vision he saw this cross with some instructions that told him to build the cross and conquer with the cross. He built it. So he came to the conclusion that Christianity was true. Many real born-again Christians in those days argued about whether the man was even saved. He certainly didn't care about theology. He cared about politics. He cared about unity. He did not want a schism in the church. And there was a schism about whether or not Jesus was God. He told them to settle it. They could have gotten together and decided Jesus was not God. That would have pleased Constantine just fine. As it happens, they settled on Jesus being God because they had a chance to go back and read the early Testament. And they saw that as far back as the first century, people had written that Jesus was God. Now, Dan Brown also claims that Constantine decided which books would make it into the New Testament canon. This I find fascinating. What an interesting trick. So, Constantine decided which books would make it into the New Testament canon. Allow me to make the obvious obvious. Constantine was dead when they chose which books would go into the New Testament canon. This Council of Carthage, was held in 390 AD. Constantine died in 337 AD. McFly, you don't have to be a math major to do the math. Okay, let's wrap this up. We all get fascinated with secrets and mysteries. I submit that the real Jesus in the real scriptures can satiate our appetite for holding life in awe. The God of the universe loves you so much that he took the form of a man and visited our world.
He died on the cross for our selfish natures. If you had been the only person alive, he would have come down and died just for you. That's how much he loves you. Shortly after his execution, he rose from the dead so that we too could rise from the dead someday and live forever. Okay, next question. How does one actually become a Christian? The gospel message is actually a very simple one. Gospel means good news, specifically the good news that God, at a certain point in history, became a man and walked the earth. This man, Jesus, was crucified for his teachings. 3 days later, he rose from the dead, appearing to many eyewitnesses, proving that both his claims and standards were of God. But his death was not an accident. He died deliberately and in some unexplainable fashion paid for the sins of all people. His resurrection points toward the hope of an afterlife, a time when forgiven sinners can be bodily resurrected themselves and completely recreated or born again. These brand new people will live without sin in the presence of God and fellow repentant human beings for the rest of eternity. As a promise or down payment of this future relationship with Christ, God's Spirit takes up residence within our own soul, proving his existence and helping us to live a better life by changing and eventually transforming our inward hearts and motives. The resulting relationship with God is something people must choose to enter into. The Bible defines sin as selfishness. This is something every human being is guilty of, and selfishness manifests itself in many forms, from unwarranted anger, to gossip, to lust, to jealousy, to greed. Even if I watch my actions carefully, I don't have a button I can push to make my inward emotions go away. I mentioned before how we can usually discover our sin by facing our inner hearts and motives. Not that everything in the heart is bad. People feel all kinds of wonderful things and do many good works. But if I'm half clean and half dirty, I still need a shower. When one turns to Jesus, the penalty of eternal death and separation from God is taken away. Very similar to the way a judge might remove a sentence. Supposing you were found guilty of a crime and the judge said to you, $500,000 fine or life imprisonment. Of course, you don't have that kind of money and the judge knows this. But then in an act of compassion, he takes out his checkbook and writes a check for $500,000. He hands it to you and says, take this to the cashier. Your fine has been paid. Okay, what goes through your mind? You're thinking, what's the catch? This is too good to be true. Life doesn't work like this. People don't love like this. Well, God loves you just that much. He loves you not because of deeds, but because he created you in such a way that you are personally lovable to him. If you had been the only person in this earth, he would have come down and died just for you. He not only wants to forgive your past, he wants to give you a new future, a future with him. He wants to adopt you as his son and daughter. Being born again not only means that you become a new person, but that you now have a new parent. Imagine living in an orphanage for several years of your childhood. One day the caretaker calls you into her office. A very loving, powerful man wants to adopt you. If you go home with him, he will take custody of your life and raise you as his own son and daughter. If you get out of line, he will discipline you, but he will only want your best. You don't have to go with him. You can remain an orphan if you wish, but once you sign the dotted line, you belong to him. Becoming a Christian is signing the dotted line. I'm not saying that God is a male. God's eternal essence is a mystery. But the Bible does use a parenting symbol when it calls God our Heavenly Father. The idea behind this is that we have all had parents. These relationships were meant to serve as an example of what a relationship with God would be like. Some of you had good parents who raised you right, protected you, and always made you feel loved. Others had terrible relationships, but even in these cases, you frequently imagine in your dreams what it would be like to have a parent who took care of you, spent time with you, and loved you unconditionally. Loved you regardless of what you looked like, what kinds of grades you got. So I'm talking in terms of a relationship with God. What about the people who believe they became Christians by joining a church? The New Testament does talk a lot about the importance of church, but we mustn't put the cart before the horse. Church literally means assembly. This assembly of other believers is a place for growth, mutual accountability, joint worship and fellowship. This is where we flourish after we have become born again. Once we have our new life in Jesus, we will need to be around others who have this same relationship, but the transformation comes first. I will see you next week. You are always welcome. Your questions are welcome as well.
Thank you for listening to The Bob Siegel Show. The views and opinions are solely those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent KCBQ or its sponsors. The Bob Siegel Show was brought to you in part by the Law Office of Thomas Pinkerton, helping infertile families have children. Tom Pinkerton would like to invite you to help Bob expand his radio program by donations or sponsorship. For more information about Bob's ministry, go to www.bobsiegel.net. Here, you can read Bob's articles and get information about Bob's books. That's Bob Siegel, SIEGEL.net.